Hello and welcome to this episode of the Australian Baby Boomer podcast. Today's guest, Katarina, or Kitty Nyman, is reading two excerpts from her book of memoirs, poems and short stories. Her book is titled Serenity. The first excerpt tells of her parents' experiences in Holland during the Nazi occupation in the Second World War. This story includes graphic depictions of what happened during that time, as told to Kitty by her mother one Christmas in their new country of Australia. The second excerpt will resonate with many people who have moved to a new and unfamiliar country and culture, as it speaks to the many adjustments that are needed to be made after the family moved from post-war Holland to 1950s Australia. Before beginning, here is a little bit from Kitty's biography. Kitty is a competitive equestrian, a farmer, a widow, a woman of letters, and a hobby writer who lives on her farm in Bullsbrook. She breeds peacocks and Appaloosa horses. She has been a finalist and a competition winner of writing competitions and a widely published poet. She has been feature poet at the Moon Cafe, where Perth Poetry Club gathers on Saturday afternoons to read and listen to poetry. She was a past committee member of the W.A. Yeats Society in Perth, where she met Dame Mary Durack and celebrated playwright Dorothy Hewitt. And she attended a poetry class with Elizabeth Jolly, who said to her students, "For nothing contributes more to the soul than a purpose, a point on which to fix the intellectual eye." Thank you to Kitty for sharing just a couple of her stories here today. I am hopeful that she will be able to return in the future to share even more. Kitty, you've written in your memoirs about your parents' experiences of the war, and I think today you've kindly agreed to read that story through to us, which I heard and I found quite eye-opening at the time.
Yes, that's quite good, Iris. I'm on to page 84, and the book's called Serenity, Memoirs, Poems, Short Stories, and Other Favourite Lines. It starts off with, "It was Christmas time. I hadn't seen my mother in a week or so. I thought it was best to call in and visit her. My two sons and I jumped in the car as the sun was going down in lovely silhouettes decorating the sky. We arrived in front of Oma's house, where the children ran in, then hugged and cuddled her. One bottle of champagne came out with dashes of orange juice. Music started to play on a hyped-up stereo. Christmas carols were sung and records started to slip in and out of their covers. Records that were never used, and memories were brought to life. The Germans," she said. Mother was 67. She came out to Australia in 1951. She had been born in a little town called Susvergent, on the border of Holland and Belgium. "The Germans," she said, "I remember them well, and I've always hated Germans. I remember when your father and I owned the shop and would get a German customer. I couldn't serve them. I'd go to your dad, I'd quietly tell him, 'I can't serve them,' and I'd leave the shop. During the war," she said, "I was pushing a pram, Kitty. You're in my stomach, your brother was on my hand, and your sister was in the pram. The Germans made me stop and put guns to my back. I could feel the cold metal behind my woolen jumper. There was a bridge over a canal, and a truck was parked on it with German soldiers guarding it. There were prisoners inside it. It was a very grey day. And four men stepped out, reluctantly, out of the van. The guards lined up and shot them dead. There was still a gun at the back of my shoulders. I was made to stand and watch the executions, along with men, women, and young children watching. Another four prisoners leapt out of the truck again, picked up the dead bodies, laid them in the truck as blood was coming from them. Now many people had guns pointing at them. They had to witness and watch the execution of four more people, and their bodies fell. If they didn't watch the execution, if they dropped their heads, the Germans would notice, shout at them, and make them look. Four more men left from the van. They picked up the bodies and put them back inside. And they bravely stood, and they were shot dead. And four more jumped from the van and picked them up. After clearing the falling bodies, they were told to stand in a line and also shot. My mother cried as she told me of the 16 prisoners that had been executed that day on the canal bridge. She looked at me and patted me on the shoulder and said, "Then there was the other day." The other day? Mother lifted the champagne glass to her lips and drank it. When 48 people lay on the streets dead, there was an air raid. And with my pram and children was lucky to be in an air raid shelter. I hugged her. It seemed a safe place for me to be in her tummy when all these terrible things were going on. "I stayed in the shelter," she said, "for 14 hours, and your brother had no food. Your sister had food, she was feeding on my breast, but your brother had nothing. He wouldn't take the breast, he was too big. For 14 hours I was in the shelter, and when eventually we left, my head hit the light, and I began walking home along the street," Mother said. Now, German soldiers didn't point guns at me, but they stood in a strange place, and I noticed, she said, dead bodies laying about their feet. Occasionally, as we walked through the streets, we saw next to every dead body there was a soldier guarding it. It seemed strange, and I didn't quite understand, she said. I was too eager to get my babies and my unborn child home to the safety of my house. There were these 48 German soldiers standing. I remember the number well. It was written in the papers, Mother said. And by their boots were 48 bodies. The Germans were guarding them, so no civilians could touch or cover them. And they had to lay there as punishment. They had to lay there as a warning to the people. The bodies were guarded as a gruesome reminder. So when everyone went shopping or went out, there was a soldier, and next to him was a body lying on the cement, and no man was allowed to touch it. My mother wept, and she said, "And they swelled up, and they were horrible. And there were fathers, and there were little girls, and there were sons and daughters," as she pushed the pram between them. And the guards stood quietly joking to each other, guarding one or two of these with their guns strapped over their shoulders, letting the pedestrians and the people walk amongst them. They were letting nobody pick up the dead and cart them to a respectable burial. For 3 days and nights they guarded. The people walked amongst them as a sadistic punishment and a warning to obey the Germans. My mother hugged me and wept. The Christmas tree glistened, and she pointed to the ornaments on the tree, which were also 40 years old. They were the ornaments which were bought back from Amsterdam. I have nothing against Jews, she said. I like Jewish people. But they were hunted by the Germans, and we were in Holland, and we were scared of everybody who caused any problems. It was very hard for us also. She cried loudly. Your father, she said, sipping some more champagne. He was in the Navy, as you know, for 12 years. He told me of incident on the battleship he was serving on in the Second World War. One of the cooks, kitchen workers. Hank was his name, from Zaandam, big strong fellow. Had to empty the scraps from the kitchen over the side every evening. There was this one night Hank was hit by a big wave and it pulled him overboard into the black ocean, the cold water, many feet below. The battleship kept going, but luckily the first mate saw it from the top deck, Hank, alone, except for the black sky, the cold ocean, watching the destroyer sink over the earth, into the distance, out of sight in the darkness of the night. He battled the waves, treading water, praying for a miracle in the cold. My mother looked at me. Haven't you heard your father tell you the story? No, I said, as I refilled a glass again of champagne. And what happened to Omar? Asked my son. To the sailor in the sea. The first mate, who saw Hank go overboard, raised the alarm. But the captain needed approval from head office before he could turn the destroyer around. That took hours. Remember, this is wartime, and warships are always in danger of German U-boats trying to sink them. So, with its lights out, it moved back across the ocean the way it came, after getting approval to turn around. When they reached the area where Hank fell overboard, they switched off the engine so they could listen for his call. Shouts could suddenly be heard, and the cold, shivering man was plucked out of the sea to the shouts of hooray, hooray, the sailors on board being joyous and happy at the rescue of their mate out of the cold ocean. His prayers were heard.
Wow. That's, I just think the way that you've written the story that you've been told is so powerful.
Well, it was strange, Iris, because I came home, put the boys to bed, and I sat at the kitchen table, and I had to get it down in a diary. And I remember sitting there in the quiet of the house, reflecting exactly what Mother said and did. And I wanted to get the real spirit of what she said,
yep,
and of that occasion, because it's very rare to get a person telling a story. They don't always want to recall the bad things that happened to them. So I'm grateful that I got it down.
It's such I think occasions like Christmas, when families get together and they have a few drinks, it's almost like time to be able to have the space to tell those stories, and that doesn't happen in a busy day-to-day life often, isn't it? So,
no.
So, I mean, what a gift for you to have that understanding of what your mother, what your father went through as well. And
well, thank you, Iris. I have got a small article here that I wrote on page 87 Would you like me to read
that? I would love that. Thank you. Yes.
It's about what my parents missed when they came to Australia. And I found one of the biggest things that they missed was the Feast of St. Nicholas. It's a traditional festivity celebrated on the evening of December the 5th, with family gatherings, meals, including Kerstkranz, a favourite delicacy, like a Christmas cake. And the day of the 6th, small gifts are given. Then the arrival of St. Nicholas from Spain on a steamboat, according to legend. And many decorated boats are used for this big occasion, along with the ringing of church bells to welcome him. There waits his snow-white horse, Amerigo, to carry him on through the streets, dressed in his fine red cape, with a peaked gold-striped red mitre on his head, along with his white gloves and, very important, his red ruby ring. He holds a long gold coiffure, ceremonial shepherd's staff, with a fancy curled top, also carrying a big red book in which is written whether each child has been good or naughty in that year. St. Nicholas has his helpers, a Moor from Spain, who is black, called Svatan Peter, which interprets as Black Peter. He is dressed in 16th century clothes of nobles, in colourful attire, lace collar, featured cap, and over time has grown from one helper to now six helpers. Svatan Peter writes the names of the naughty children and catches them and puts them in a jute bag to take away to Spain as punishment. This has been an accepted part of tradition, brought down from the 16th century generation to generation, and has helped many girls and boys to be well behaved, always being reminded about the jute bag in which children go away from home to be punished by Black Peter. He also carries a birch rod or a chimney sweep's broom made of willow branches to spank all the naughty children. Nice children are given candy, gingerbread cookies called Papernoten and speckle ice. After they buy their shoes by the door with a wish list, a nice drawing and a carrot for the horse. In return, St. Nicholas leaves sweets in their shoes. The Sinterklaas is a most important tradition for the Dutch. Over the years, Father Christmas came into Europe, but many countries banned him completely and fined businesses for not obeying the rules. Father Christmas was not allowed in only after 6th of December, that is St. Nicholas Day, and not before, in Holland. They upheld the centuries-old tradition of St. Nicholas, who gives sage advice, helps with praising good children and punishing difficult ones, and is a big religious figure with a long history of traditions and customs. There was so much opposition to Father Christmas, who is a commercially marked figure, causing a frenzy of shopping and expense. So many action groups sprang up to save St. Nicholas. I can go on a little more. It goes on about what my parents missed. We leave St. Nicholas for a moment.
Yes, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because that tradition is quite ancient, isn't it, or quite old, the tradition of the St. Nicholas and Black Peter, I guess. Is that still done in Holland, do you know, or is that gone by the wayside now? Because, you know, a lot of those traditions would now be kind of under scrutiny because of Black Peter.
I agree, Iris. There is, as you say, scrutiny about Black Peter. But the tradition of St. Nicholas Day, I could say, is bigger than ever. And there are hundreds and hundreds of people, usually on a wharf side or a canal side or near water. There are hundreds and hundreds of people watching St. Nicholas get off the boat. Mm. Fortunately, I've only seen it the one time, or two times in my life. Once, very fortunately, I happened to be in Holland accidentally on that time. And sure enough, he came off a boat, from a canal boat, and straight onto a horse with his beautiful robes. And then he took everybody into a hall and talked to all the children. It was an enormous day for the Dutch people.
Mm.
And it still is. So to answer your question,
yes,
he's surviving.
Yes, it's a huge festival. I think it's interesting to have different types of Christmas festivals for different countries, and but I guess St. Nicholas would be across quite a few European countries, would that be the case?
You are right, yes, it is across quite a few European countries.
Whereas the Father Christmas was more of a commercial figure that came through advertising, really. I think the red and white suit of Father Christmas was originally through some soft drink company. It was an advertising ploy originally, I think.
You are right.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting, Kitty. So was there another little bit you wanted to read about the migrant experience?
Yes, well, my parents also missed the Dutch food, the cheeses, the Gouda, Edam cheese, the Leyden cheese, the pastries filled with almond marzipan and chocolate, spices, sausages to make soups and black bread, traditional Dutch music with piano accordion. Mother loved to attend, yes.
And I was going to say, they would have come out in the 1950, is that right? So
yes.
none of that would have been available back then.
You're right, Iris.
In Australia.
You are correct. Fortunately, Dutch butchers did start making beautiful Dutch breads with almond marzipan and kaaskrants, and of course the Dutch shops, one or two Dutch shops, sell the speculaas biscuits, which you can buy in most shops now. So at that time it was very hard to get these things. Father had cheese brought over especially by mail, and he had the Edam cheese come over, and Father also had the herrings come over in barrels for himself. Of course, that's all different now. You can buy those things in many shops.
Mm-hmm.
Mother loved to attend carnival street parades where everybody dresses up in fancy clothes in Sassvergent, as well as a celebration on the 27th of April called the King's Day, the Koninginsdag, wearing lots of hats, scarves, masks, then feasting with music and dancing. The clothing the family was used to in Holland was so different here in Australia. Heavy knitted clothing, jumpers, socks, crocheted singlets, long winter coats, hats, big bows in our hair, and big weather changes were hard for my parents to get used to in Holland. Spring begins on the 20th of March, summer the 21st of June, autumn the 23rd of September, and winter the 22nd of December, and what is called the naked season, November the 15th. The leaves are all gone till the 19th of March, when spring begins. My dad loved to eat Dutch herrings with a little white onion, so much so that he often had many wooden barrels specially sent over to Perth. On New Year's Eve, Mother would cook us traditional fried olibolam, lots of sultanas, rolled up dough with icing sugar on top, with apple jacks, sliced apples fried and covered with cream. Many favourite foods Mother cooked for us from Holland: pancakes, pannekoeken, apple tart, bitterballen and stamppot. My favourite with hot mash, potatoes, carrots and ham pieces that I cook myself often. Back in 1951, Mother had to learn to cook on a wood stove situated outside the tent. The Mandurah migrant camp consisted of a bush settlement, several wooden buildings, 20 tents and Nissen huts, no protection from insects, surrounded by grass, trees, banksias and gums, with knee-high grasses. Our tent was overrun by mice. It had loose floorboards, a table, sink and a large water tank that housed frogs. Tadpoles fell into the sink at times, to the horror of my mother, as she turned on the one dripping tap. Some distance from our tent was a laundry where a boiler supplied any hot water we needed for the bathroom. Mother and Father needed to be very tough and resilient to meet these extreme challenges with three young children and to accept the new Australian way of life. They needed to work, save money and find a home or a shop to buy for themselves, and this was very hard in a tent miles away from Mandurah, without transport, faced with long gravel roads and sometimes only sand tracks to a bus stop. Mother had difficulty with the new language to learn from the start, but Father has sustained in Fremantle many times in the war, was stationed in Fremantle many times in the war with the Navy, so he had a good understanding of English language, although unable to write it. My sister and I soon got bikes and went to the Mandurah State School, a long distance from the camp. The early days were not trouble-free, my eldest brother running away and my father having a serious accident while working on the Mandurah Bridge. A plank slipped, he fell, breaking both arms and his jaw. Hospitalised for weeks, he was unable to eat solid food for a long time. A small lump of wages and sick pay and compensation gave him funds to buy his first shop in Onslow Road, Shenton Park. Both mother and father were homesick, missed their parents, brothers and sisters and friends to visit at times. Their dreams disappeared, and mother felt misled from the promise of a better life when all they were trying to do was to return to a similar standard of living they had experienced in Holland before the war. But in the migrant camp was standard housing, a tent, insect plagues, mosquitoes and flies. They became very disillusioned, having to face these unpleasant experiences, and now had to fit it in and be and act like Australians. With weeks of temperatures from 31 to 40 was unbearable for them, coming from a cool climate of rain and snow. Mother rested with a wet towel to cool herself, giving us face cloths to wipe our faces repeatedly, a new unexpected heat she never knew. Yet my father spoke of gorgeous sunshine and blue skies and warm weather, but they had not experienced long, hot Perth summers until they arrived. Here people didn't worry how they dressed, many going barefoot, having a she'll be right mate attitude, my father being told, "You don't wear a suit in the pub, mate." Mother being used to wearing a hat and gloves while going to her first job as a housemaid and cleaner in the Peninsula Hotel to look nice. But she soon realised she was overdressed and left her hat and gloves at home. As children, we often heard stories of our journey on the ship, the Grote Bear, the Big Bear, the disgraceful conditions on board, protectively, no facilities for washing and ironing, long queues to use the dirty toilets and bathrooms, and terrible food, packed like sardines in cabins with nowhere to put clothing. My parents didn't think conditions would be so bad on the boat trip over, leaving Amsterdam on the 23rd of the 2nd, 1951. But they arrived safely on the 21st of the 3rd, 1951. away from the horrible experience of war, fear, hunger and cold, out of war-torn Holland, with queues of people needing meals, broken, smashed, bombed homes, to a new life, safe, happy life for them and their three children. I often think of my brave parents in February of 1951, full of hope and uncertainty, standing on the bridge of the ship with a band playing, a final farewell, flags flying and happy shouts to the family, waving on the wharf below, smiling, then distracted by the reality that slowly overtook them. As a ship moved away, blowing its horn, casting aside the big ropes that held it, like the breaking of a strong blood bonds of mothers and fathers from loved sons and daughters, never to see them again for 15 years, completely consumed with a powerful force to succeed in a new land. Now only blue airmail letters from Holland kept them close as time changed them forever. Thank you.
Goodness. Thank you, Kitty. That's I can see that that's moved you and brought back the memories of the struggles your parents went through in. And it's such a brave thing to move from a country and from everything you know and from all the people you know to come to Australia, which is the story of so many people, because we are predominantly a migrant population.
I'd like to thank Kitty for so generously sharing these stories of her parents' experiences during the Second World War and afterwards upon their arrival in Australia. I think their stories, as difficult as they are, would resonate with many. I hope to bring more stories and reflections from a range of people in the coming year. And again, thank you for listening.